Good morning and welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. We're a spiritual community dedicated to the free search for truth and meaning. We're very glad you're here. I extend a special welcome to those of you who are visiting with us for the first time. If you have questions about this faith or about this congregation, don't hesitate to ask the people at the visitor table, and they will do their best to help you out. We come from a long heritage of teaching that there is a spark of the divine in every person. So it is in the spirit of that heritage that I say, let us greet the holy in our midst by turning to the person to your right and left and welcoming them here this morning. Will you say with me the words by which we light our chalice? In the light of truth and the warmth of love, we gather to seek, to find, and to share.
Good morning. I'm Marcia Sharp, your lay leader for this morning. Our reading this morning is by David C. Pohl. We come to this time and this place to rediscover the wondrous gift of free religious community, to renew our faith in the in the holiness, goodness, and beauty of life, to reaffirm the way of the open mind and full heart, to rekindle the flame of memory and hope, and to reclaim the vision of an earth made fair with all her people one.
Many people ask what is at the center for this congregation when we have people here whose beliefs and practices and roots are a combination of many different world religions. We have people whose backgrounds are in almost all of them, including neo-paganism and staunch secular humanism. So what holds us together? One of the things that holds this congregation together is its mission statement. And we wrote it on the wall, and we say it together on Sunday mornings. We gather in community to nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice. Now is the time in our service when we settle together and breathe deeply, where we seek the still place where we can speak to God as we understand God, or listen to our inner wisdom, or just follow our breath as it goes in and out of our bodies. We seek the still place because we are taught that it is in stillness that we can receive clarity, that we can sink our roots deep into the heart of compassion, that we can become spiritually sturdy enough to be good companions to those who are rejoicing and those who are sorrowing. Let us enter into the wise silence together, keeping in mind that in this congregation, the small noises of children and the sounds of life are part of silence. I've been preaching a series of sermons called What's the Difference? And this morning it's going to be What's the Difference Between Protestants and Catholics? So we're going to go through 1,500 years of history pretty quickly, and then 500 more pretty quickly, too. So I'm going to be painting with broad strokes. Please have patience with the loss of any detail if I happen to step in your field at some point along the path. So the history of the Christian religion goes back to the days after the death of Rabbi Jesus, and some would then say, and his resurrection. So The disciples were confused. They had a totally different picture of what was going to happen. And the Christian scriptures say that 49 days after the first day of Passover, which is the day when all of the events leading up to the crucifixion happened, 49 days after that, the disciples were huddled in a room together, and suddenly a wind rushed through the room, and tongues of flame appeared on the disciples' heads, and they began speaking in tongues. This is called Pentecost. It's one of the great festivals of the Christian church. It's the day on which I was ordained many long years ago, 135 years ago. So one kind of literal mind would read the story and say, so there were literal tongues of fire on the heads of the people, and they were speaking in unknown tongues, which are tongues of angels, tongues unknown to anyone on earth. So that's one kind of literal mind. And then another kind of literal mind would say, that can't happen. So it must be that it's their way of talking about people having a sudden inspiration or an idea. Like we would put a light bulb on somebody's head. They would, of course, not having light bulbs, would say, suddenly there was a tongue of fire on top of their heads. And so maybe the wind rushing through was just an inspiration. And maybe the tongues they spoke were because they were like, hey, I know what we're supposed to do now. We're supposed to carry this story to many nations. I know the language they speak over there. And somebody else would say, I know the language they speak over there. And everybody giving a little example of the languages they knew might look a little the same. So if you have a literal mind in that skeptical way, there's one way of seeing it. If you have a literal mind in that other way, there's another way of seeing it. If you have a metaphorical mind, you're pretty comfortable either way. And so the story began to spread. The disciples began to spread the story, and the spreaders of the story, because they were all Jewish, and they were thinking that they were speaking the truth about what Judaism should be, because, you know, Jesus was Jewish, and you all know that. So they were reforming Judaism, and there were Jewish officials who were trying to stamp out this reform, because officials always like to stamp out reform. Nobody likes reform. So one of the big persecutors was a guy named Saul, and he was executing Christians, trying and executing them. Although the story goes that one day he was on the road to Damascus, which is in Syria. We hear a lot about Syria, and they still call it Damascus. He was on the road to Damascus, Syria, and suddenly a huge light came and blinded him, and he was blind for 3 days, and in this experience, he converted. He had had a conversation with Jesus, the risen spirit of Jesus, and he became less of a, well, he became not a persecutor anymore, but a preacher, a spreader of the gospel himself. And as a Roman citizen, he had a lot more weight than any of the disciples did, and he traveled a lot more. He had the rights to travel, and he had Roman citizenship, which gave him a huge amount of privilege, and he used that privilege to get in all the places in the Roman Empire that could hear the gospel. Now, the disciples had been preaching the gospel that if you were a Gentile, non-Jewish, then you had to become Jewish in order to be a follower of Jesus. And the recruitment was difficult because in order to become Jewish, you had to get circumcised. Paul realized or thought or was whatever, said you don't have to become Jewish first. So that made it a lot easier for people to go straight from worshiping Diana or Zeus to worshiping Jesus and becoming a Christian. So since it was easier, they had a little fight about it at first. You know, Peter, who thought you had to become Jewish first, and Paul had conflicts. But Paul won. He had more privilege and more traveling, and more people were becoming Christian. So finally Peter went, okay. And anyway, he had a vision too that made it all right. Another story, another sermon. So the word spread. and there were lots of gospels that were written to tell the story of Jesus. There was the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary. There were the Gospels, of course, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There were tens of gospels that were written, and people were reading different ones, and there were tens of teachers who were teaching the rules of who Jesus was, who humanity is in relationship to God and Jesus, and who, what you should do to live a good life, and what had happened with the crucifixion, what that was all about. Lots of different teachers who had followers. Each one had followers. And the followers, you know, even the followers of Hillary and Bernie can start fighting, even though their positions are very similar. And so the followers of the, because this is human nature. You want to be on your team and you want to go, we rule, you drool. And so the followers of the different teachers were doing this very thing. And they would make up songs and they would sing them in the tavern and drown each other out. And it was starting to hurt the cohesiveness of the empire. So when Emperor Constantine became the emperor, he declared Christianity the official religion of the empire. His mother had become a Christian, and so he was, probably. He said to the bishops and to the Christians, you guys are tearing my empire apart. Get it together. Decide what you want to teach. Decide what Christianity is, since now you've made it this new religion, since people don't have to become Jews anymore. Now it's its own thing. So decide what is orthodoxy. That means what is the right answer to all the questions. Decide what is orthodoxy. And so the bishops and clergy had their first church council in Nicaea, 325. So they all gathered in Nicaea, and one of the things that they did was they wrote the Nicene Creed, which is a list of things Christianity believes. And many of y'all who grew up Roman Catholic grew up reciting the Nicene Creed. They also decided that there would be four Gospels in the Scriptures, and they decided on Matthew and Mark and Luke and John. Those were the Gospels. The Gospel of Thomas was out. The Gospel of Mary was out. All the other Gospels were out. And this one, these four, were going to be the Gospels. So they began teaching the orthodoxy and persecuting the heretics, one of whom we are descended from, Arius. That's another sermon too. And the church then, over the next 1,000 years, evolved. And they borrowed a lot of pagan festivals and made them into Christian festivals throughout. So we've got Christmas at Saturnalia time, and we've got Easter at springtime, and there's nothing wrong with that. So things rocked along for a little while until the barbarians came and conquered the Roman Empire. This didn't happen all at once, but the reason they call them barbarians is because reading wasn't really their thing. It was more like war was their thing. And so after the barbarians and the fall of Rome, the civilization, the way they knew it, was wiped out for a while, and civilization became a different thing, a time of more small wars and small chieftains and peasants just trying to survive on the land, and people not really valuing reading as much. This is what we're taught, anyway. It's possible that there were people who valued reading a lot who were barbarians and don't deserve the name, and I'll do more research as we go. So now we're in the Middle Ages, and nobody much is reading. Some priests still know how to read. They're copying books by hand. Many priests, though, don't know how to read. There are not that many, since you're copying the Bible by hand, there are not that many Bibles. So in many huge cathedrals, there would be one Bible, and it's chained there, and some people can read it. But most people just get their news about what's in the Bible from the priests, who sometimes can't read themselves, who got the news about the Bible from somebody else. And people learn from the music, and they learn from the stained glass windows, because a lot of times the stories in the Bible are in the stained glass windows. And gradually, there comes a situation in the 1500s where there was some corruption in the ranks of the clergy. There was a lot of pressure to fundraise. The Crusades had been expensive. Everything is expensive. Churches are constantly short of money. And so they had been practicing this thing called an indulgence. So you get a gift of an indulgence from your sin, which is some time off of purgatory or some difficulty knocked off of your penance. Maybe the priest was going to do some of your penance for you. You got a gift of an indulgence if you made a very good deed for the church, or if you were a especially wonderful person. But by the 1500s, it kind of became corrupt in a lot of ways, and they were pretty much just selling the indulgences. So if you needed an indulgence for having had a wild party, that was going to be $300, and the priests would do your penance for you. Some people even were going so far as to buy them ahead of time so that they could, you know, sin without worrying too much about it. And many people felt that that wasn't right. One particular priest named Martin Luther wrote up all the reasons why he felt indulgences were not effective and had no power. These were called the 95 Theses. Disputing the efficacy and power of indulgences. Legend said that he nailed his paper to the door of the cathedral in Wittenberg. And those are called the 95 Theses. Sometimes you'll hear people talk about that. That's what that is. It's got to do with Martin Luther and indulgences. So, no one would have heard about it much if it hadn't been for, in the mid-1400s, a goldsmith named Gutenberg put together a printing press that could turn out about 3,600 pages a day with movable type. The printing press had been invented in Korea in the 1300s and before that in China, because the Chinese get to everything first. But it had made its way to Europe, and Gutenberg made this mechanized press that could turn out all of these pages, and he printed the 95 Theses, and he printed a Latin Bible. He printed a Bible in the late 1400s, in Latin, of course. So some people who were learned and spoke Latin could start reading the Bible for themselves. This changed everything. People began to want what their priests taught to match up with what was in the Bible. This was a problem. The indulgences were not in the Bible anywhere. Neither was the Trinity, according to some thinkers. But they burned them at the stake pretty fast. But the indulgences thing really took hold. And more people began reading the Bible, and more people began protesting what was the corruption of the Roman Catholic Church at that time. And the protesters were called Protestants. That's how we get the word Protestant, because they were the ones protesting. So I know you know all this. I'm just putting it all together in a quick way for you. So the Protestants had many differences with the Roman Catholic Church. They liked really plain sanctuaries that didn't have any stained glass because they wanted your learning to come right from the Bible. And they wanted no statues in there and no art in there because nothing to distract you from the Bible. And some of them didn't even want any music because beautiful organ music, as you know, can make you think thoughts that might not be in the Bible. Not necessarily anything wrong with those thoughts, but the glory of the organ took away from the glory of God. This is John Calvin, the forebearer of my Presbyterian people. Now, Martin Luther, the forebearer of Lutheran people, he liked organ music and he liked beer. Martin Luther was German. It is said that he had a mug with the Lord's Prayer painted on it, and he could drink all the way to thy kingdom come in one gulp. This has to do with the differences between Protestant denominations, and that's another What's the Difference sermon, which will come sometime later. So, and the Protestants also didn't just leave it, like, we don't believe in art and we don't like statues. They actually would rampage through Catholic churches smashing things, like the Taliban, with righteousness. There are three main early declarations that the Protestants made that differentiated them from the Catholics. One was in Latin, sola scriptura, which means only through scripture. What does that mean? It means we can only know God through the scripture. We don't know God through the teachings of the church. The church could be wrong. This was a scandal. To people who felt like the church was always right. But the Protestants said the church could be wrong, and you only learn about God through the Bible, and you should read it for yourself and not let somebody else be in between you and God. The sola scriptura tenet is the reason that Protestant ministers study the Bible, and some Protestant denominations, Presbyterians particularly, have to learn Hebrew and Greek to study the Bible in its original, so you're not even trusting anybody translating it for you. So you're really dealing directly with the scriptures the way you have them right now. And people say, oh, they were copied over and over again, there are lots of mistakes in them, but no, we found the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we found out that they were copied pretty accurately. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found in the 60s, and they compared the manuscripts which had been copied and written, and we're like, wow, they didn't make very many mistakes at all. Not to say that everything was still comprehensible. It wasn't. In the Roman Catholic tradition and the Episcopal tradition, church teaching and church tradition has equal weight with the Bible. That's why Episcopalian doesn't really fit with Protestant. It's an offshoot of Roman Catholicism. And then Protestants over here are the Lutherans, the Methodists, Presbyterians, the Baptists, etc. The second only, sola, the second sola is sola fide, means only by faith. It's only by faith that you're saved, unwritten, saved from hell. It's only by faith that you're saved. So you can't be saved by good works. Like you can, you're supposed to do good works. But in the Roman Catholic tradition and in the Episcopal tradition, your good works count for something. In the Protestant traditions, your good works, they're okay. But, and again, this is a difference in the denominations. You're supposed to be a good person, but they don't really count toward heaven. Only Jesus' good works count toward heaven. And so you have faith and you believe correctly, and then you get to heaven because he was good, not because you're good. And they'll even say, they'll quote a passage from Isaiah that says, this is the Presbyterians particularly, which I have studied extensively at Princeton Seminary. They say, your righteousness is as filthy rags. So, you know, your righteousness just doesn't, it's less than counting for something. So it's only by faith. So you're supposed to do good works, but your actions are not what gets you there. In non-Protestant churches, you have to do certain things to get to heaven. Like you have to tithe and you go to mass and you don't do anything heinous. And then you do your penance and you do your confession and do things right. And then you go to heaven. So that's a difference. And then the third difference is sola gratia, only by grace. So only by grace are you saved. Now, some extreme Protestants say this means that there is no step you can take, nothing that you can do that will even make you decide to have faith. That it's only God reaching down and saying in God's grace, you will now have faith. And so if you don't have faith, corollary, God didn't reach down and touch you. Which leaves a bunch of us questioning. In the churches where, and among the Protestant denominations, there's a kind of a continuum about how much partnership they think people have in their own salvation. And in the partnership churches, they do things like wait until the age of reason before they baptize you, because you have some choice in the matter. You choose to believe. In the churches that don't believe you have choice in the matter, they baptize the infants, because what's the difference? When you're adult, you can't choose. When you're a baby, you can't choose. Just get baptized when you're a baby. It symbolizes that we're all infants all the time when it comes to understanding theology. In churches that believe you have some partnership in your salvation, you come forward to get communion. In churches that believe you don't have any choice, know that it's only by grace, fundamentally only by grace, the communion comes to you when you sit in the pew. Does that make sense? Okay. Let's talk about Unitarian Universalism now. We have more roots with the Protestants than with the Roman Catholics. So, like the Protestants, we don't have priests. This is born out, we believe in the priesthood of all believers, that you all are ministers, so we all are ministers. I'm a professional minister, but that doesn't make me holier than you, just makes me more trained. We're all ministers. This comes to light even in our things like our animal blessing service. When you don't bring the animals forward to be blessed by the priest, we bless our animals together. That's the priesthood of all believers. We center the worship service on the word, not the Bible, but the word of the minister and the music. So we don't center on a ritual that is the same every Sunday. So we're like Protestants in that way. Our sanctuaries are usually plain. Sometimes there's a brave little committee that puts art on the walls of the sanctuaries. They usually burn out pretty soon. Sometimes we light candles. In this congregation, we light candles. Apparently, one lady left because it was too Catholic for her. But this is something that we've borrowed from the Catholics, and we like it very much. It's not non-Protestant to light candles. And we could be non-Protestant if we want to, because we're Unitarian Universalists. Unlike Catholics or Protestants, we center authority in the individual. In our first hymn, I don't know if you knew how much theology you were learning in this hymn. It sounded kind of old-fashioned, but the second verse, I'm going to just talk through it to you because these are the things we believe. Reason is noble. Truth is growing. There's not a truth, boom, learn it, don't argue with it, that's it. Truth is growing. And then they say it again. Our conscience speaks condemnation or proclaims something as true. Our conscience. That's where authority lies, is in the individual in relationship to the community. Just so if you're going off base for some reason, your community can gently bring you back. While thine inward revelation told thy saints their prayers were heard, it's the inward revelation that we trust. See? And then here in the last verse, it talks about revelation is not sealed. In both the Catholic and the Protestant church, but especially Protestant, because they don't trust church tradition, revelation is sealed. That's it. There's no more. So you dig in and you learn what's there. But our revelation is ongoing. We believe that you can keep learning about humanity. You keep learning about the mystery. And so we bless one another. And we keep learning and we keep studying. And we find tremendous courage in the belief that there's no eternal punishment for being wrong. You can be wrong, might make you feel bad, because we hate making mistakes, most of us, especially the firstborns among us. But it's not a matter of life and death. You can just say, oh man, I was wrong. I'm changing my mind now. And you can change your mind about the truth as you see it. It doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you. It means the revelation continued to be revealed to you. And our hope is not that our actions will save us, but that our actions will take steps toward healing the world. And our hope is not in someone coming to save us, but our hope is in love, in action, in justice, in one another, and in the mystery that comes bidden or unbidden to bring us insight and clarity and joy and grace. So that's the difference. Will you say with me the words by which we extinguish our chalice? We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we hold in our hearts until we are together again. Let the life I lead speak for me. Let the life I lead speak for me. When I'm lying in my grave and there's nothing left to say, let the life I lead speak for me. Let the friends I've made, let the friends I've made speak for me. Let the friends I've made speak for me. When I'm lying in my grave and there's nothing left to say, let the friends I've made speak for me. Let the love I give, let the love I give speak for me. Let the love I give speak for me. When I'm lying in my grave and there's nothing left to say, let the love I give speak for me. Go in peace.
This is a production of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, go to our website at www.austinuu.org.